So it's the air in here. I spent, I think, 3 or 4 days in this complex. And when I get up in the morning, I speak like Johnny Depp. Yeah. And I didn't deserve that. Okay. How about this? Okay? It means I have to hunch a little bit, but still. How sad is this? I have a laptop with bookmarks in it. And also one that isn't, for some reason, coming on. Come on. It has to work. Well, we'll leave it working there for a little while. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Terry Pratchett. If this comes as a surprise to you, you have a little bit of time left in which to leave. Some 6 months ago, I wrote a worthy and learned treatise to deliver to you today. Come on, damn you! Doesn't matter, I think I have it memorized. However, some events eventuated in the meantime. Having got you all here, I'm going to tell you about my operation. It turned out that I had very high blood pressure. So for 3 months, I had high blood pressure and pills that weren't doing any good, which made my blood pressure go up higher. Then for 3 months, I had high blood pressure. I had low blood pressure and pills that were working, and they were maximum strength beta blockers, which are, brothers and sisters, the devil's face flannel. It was like having a red-hot towel on my brain. And then they got it all sorted out, and they found that since I had no history of heart disease in my family, a low cholesterol level, didn't smoke, didn't drink strong drink much, wasn't overweight, and exercised regularly, of course I had heart disease. I complained about this, and they said, tough luck, that's how it happens. And so I had an angiogram. And that was kind of weird, because, as you know, they actually operate on your heart via your groin. Now, the heart and groin are sometimes linked in other ways, but this is the first time I have happened upon it in a hospital. And it was all quite okay. They give you a little something which makes you a wee bit sleepy, and you're allowed to watch the operation on television. What I particularly remember, they said, is there any particular music you'd like to listen to? And I said, I hadn't thought about it at the time, you know. You've got some Jim Steinman. And they said, fine. And they put on Bat Out of Hell. And this is great, and they got on with the thing. I was watching what they were doing, you know, there was my heart on the screen. And then I realized that I was nodding off, and I thought, but this is so cool. The last thing I see is my heart still beating. uh, Then I had to have the stents put in. You know, these things that collapse. You've probably been following the various legal cases if you have any heart problems, as I have. But mine apparently are okay. And that's rather a more serious operation. And beforehand, you go and talk to the doctor. He explains this. Nothing to worry about. It's quite simple. You'll be out next day. And, oh, by the way, will you sign this document? Oh, yes. What's this document? That enables us to take you away and give you a full-on open-heart surgery if necessary. Not that we'll have to do this at all, of course. And, by the way, my son thinks your books are really good. I said, if you would like your son to continue to be happy, may I advise some caution tomorrow? And again, I was wheeled into the surgery. No Jim Steinman this particular time. Gently slid under. Woke up in my room, God knows how many hours later, with a nurse pressing hard on my groin. And so, what can a man say? Where were you when I was 18? And I said, what happened? Did it all work? Yes, they've gone in fine. No problems. We have to stop you bleeding from the artery. And the thing about bleeding from the artery, bleeding from a vein, you get drops of blood. Bleeding from an artery, the ceiling goes red. So they're more concerned about that than about the heart. And the doctor came in and said, yeah, it's fine, everything's fine. Thank you very much. And as a result of of what we found during the surgery, I'm going to change your pills because you're off the beta blockers now and there's something far more suitable for you because you apparently have some part of your brain which shuts your arteries down when you're stressed. How you manage to survive, for several million years of evolution with this amazing trait, we shall never know. And there's a little pill that works on this. And I said, so it was fine, was it? And he said, yeah, there were some fun and games. I said, well, how long was I on the slab? He said, about an hour and a half, and please stop calling it a slab. I said, and fun and games, I take it, is a medical term meaning you nearly died. He said, well, you reacted rather badly to the dye which is used to illuminate the heart, but we hit you up with something like nitroglycerine and dimorphine and everything was fine. I said, except that you kept on shouting that there was a man with sandwiches. And you kept trying to sit up on the operating table, which is, as I believe I have told you several times, not the slab, saying, there's a man with sandwiches. And they'd actually had to hold me down while they finished the operation. And I said, yes, I can remember that. There was a man, and he had sandwiches. And the doctor said, what kind were they? And I said, I don't know, you wouldn't let me get near. So that's it, brothers and sisters. Do not go towards the sandwiches. I know it's a great temptation. You will be as anxious as I was to find out if they're going to be cucumber with the crust cut off. That means you're going to go to hell. In England, if they're Branston pickle and cheese, that means you're on the way to heaven. But alas, it was only a near sandwich experience and I survived. But it is nice to know that wherever you're going to go, you're going to get something to eat on the way. However, when this happens to a man, he gets something that's known as a midlife crisis, if only because it's nearly a terminal life crisis, and asks the questions that have been bugging him for some time, like, is it really too late to get a Porsche? But mostly, what's it all about then, really, when you get down to it? And you know, I just don't know. 2 weeks ago, we had a Discworld convention in the UK, held every 2 years. Lots of Americans came to it. You could tell the Americans, they were the ones that spent a lot of time in the bar singing songs like Roll Me Over in the Clover. Because they'd been let out of California, where you're not even allowed to think songs like that. And it was great, and it was very international, and they capped the numbers at 750, which is big for a con in the UK. And on the Sunday night, I looked down at this hall, and people were having fun, and there were lots of people in costume, and they were kind of continuously creating Discworld as a kind of experiment. A guild system had been set up, and guilds had to vie with one another to get points for their guild. And as I was telling the kids earlier, you're sitting there, and a little munchkin who's now working for the Assassin's Guild comes up and goes, stabbity, stabbity, stab. That will be $2. I said, no, that's not how assassination works. You do not charge the corpse. So she thought about it and said, my friend Keith, another small munchkin salutes, he's from the Guild of Alchemists and will bring you alive again for $2. So with rigor mortis, I stuck my hand in my pocket and gave them some of the fake convention money. And then she smiled sweetly and said, and for $5, I won't kill you again. It was amazing to see how Ankh-Morpork was developed via this system. Within a few hours of it starting, the head of the Merchants Guild embezzled his guild's money to purchase the assassination of the head of the Assassin's Guild so he could take it over. And on the second day, the forged money started to appear. It was magnificent. It was Ankh-Morpork come to life. And I looked down at the hall of the people having fun and enjoying themselves and occasionally charging one another to kill them. And I thought, my work here is done. Not you. Dealing with the kids just now, I had to. It was going like Red Dwarf. Is the next question going to be related to turtles in any way whatsoever? No. Okay then. Well, the turtle. No, please. Slowing down a bit. My next book out is Going Postal. It's about a fraud, a criminal, a con man, who to some extent becomes redeemed through the book and learns that in addition to fooling everybody else, he can even fool himself into believing that he's a good guy. And a friend of mine who read a draft copy said, yes, there's a little bit of autobiography in all books, isn't there? Only friends will tell you that. Because I think I'm a fraud. I'm a guest of honour at this convention. When I was a kid, guests of honour, as I said the other night, were giants made of gold half a mile high. They had names like James Blish, Brian Aldiss, Arthur C. Clarke. I'm 5'7" and I'm never going to get any taller. I wish I could say that I had any purpose in mind when I started the Discworld series. I thought it was going to be fun. There was an awful lot of bad fantasy around in the early 1980s. There was plenty of good fantasy around, but there were just too many dark lords, or differently pigmented lords, as we call them now. And I thought it was time to have fun with this, and the Colour of Magic and the Light Fantastic were the result of this. I found that they were selling. This came as a huge surprise to me. So I wrote Equal Rights. I wrote a third of Equal Rights in one weekend after one of the nuclear power stations I was a press officer for exploded. Well, it didn't really explode. Well, not much. I mean, okay, a small explosion. And a bit of gas leaked out. But not much. And no one was killed, I think. The nervousness here comes from 8 years as a nuclear press officer. And I never really had to deal with a genuine nuclear accident. But some of the things I did have to deal with were slightly worse, from my personal point of view. The man who came onto a nuclear power station too radioactive to be allowed to leave. Which was really difficult, because when the man comes onto the station and goes through the machine that shouldn't go bing, and it goes bing, you can't let him out again, because you have to answer to the health and safety executive if someone makes the machine that shouldn't go bing when they leave. And it turned out that he had been dismantling a Second World War aircraft altimeter on his kitchen table. That's the kind of thing we Brits do the night before. And had got pure radium all over his hands. So we scrubbed him up, and the power station sent some men in nice clean suits to take his kitchen table away and put it in the low-level waste depository. Not many kitchen tables end up like that. Oh, and while I think about it, I'll mention, there's something about spending a lot of time with engineers that makes you burst out laughing when you hear the term three completely independent fail-safe systems. because there was what I called the thread factor. Someone decides, we will have a nuclear power station, and they call in leading technical architects, and they design it. And subsystems are designed by competent engineers, and subsystems designed by equally competent engineers. And so it goes down, and so it goes down, and then you get Fred. Fred has been given a job sheet and some tools, and told he's got an hour to do the job. So Fred has got to wire up three, as it might be, completely independent fail-safe systems. And he wires them up, and they're completely independent except for one wire from each system, which must go to the control room. And Fred sits there thinking, why should I drill three holes when one will clearly do? So he takes out his drill, and he drills one hole through the wall, and he runs all the wires through it, and he positions them through the wall just under the Acme sharp-edged shelving system in a bay where a small truck is shunting goods around and is backing up an awful lot. And good heavens, all three systems fail at once. That's a terrible supply. And we had a lot of Fred-type emergencies when I was on the power station, because it should be impossible, completely impossible, to pour nuclear waste down a lavatory. But no one told Fred, so when after a job of work he was cleaning the top of the reactor, he tipped a bucket of, well, from him, dirty water down the lavatory, and it was just so happening that the health physicist walking past the sump outside heard the Geiger counter suddenly go insane. Unfortunately, before they'd done this, a big tanker had already taken a lot of the sewage sludge away from the station's septic tank. So somewhere in the world was radioactive sewage, and we had to catch up with it and do something about it. So I was called in. They gave me a certificate of merit for dealing with this afterwards, and it was printed on brown paper. And what we did was we traced the sewage to a big holding tank at a local sewage works, and we said, how do you find out if 8,000 tons of sewage are radioactive? We don't know. And there was a meeting between the sewage workers and the nuclear workers, and it was interesting to see the relative concepts of danger. The nuclear workers were saying, oh, we know about nuclear material, we can handle it, it's easy to detect, it's no problem, we can deal with this. But that's sewage. And the sewage workers were saying, this is sewage, we're used to sewage, we eat and drink sewage, we know about sewage. But that's nuclear. And finally, what they did, And this was a masterpiece. All the stuff was pumped out onto big, big, big tankers and taken up to a big, big coal-fired power station in the Midlands, and it was burned. It was burned to dust. And then the dust came out on a little conveyor belt, and the man with a Geiger counter just sat there. And if it sounded again, that three times in 80 tons, it went bing. And they found three little pieces of weld spatter that was slightly radioactive. And that was it. And it was all sorted out. And I remember speaking to the guy who had actually hauled the stuff in his tanker. And I said, what did you think about all this? And he said, well, the last load I had was plums that were 3 months beyond their sell-by date. I mean, when I lifted the lid, you could actually see the glow inside. Now, that did worry me a bit. I can't remember what happened at the power station at this particular point. I know something. Fred had done something. Something had leaked, hardly anything much had really happened. But I'd spend all day answering the phones, and I was so hyper when I got home. I opened up the computer, I started to work, and my wife, this was on a Friday night, Sunday morning, my wife came up quietly, saved the work in progress, and tucked me up in bed, and that was the last third of Equal Rights. And I decided that I had to get out of the nuclear industry as quickly as I possibly could, but on the other hand, you don't want to make enemies in the nuclear industry. So I gave them 6 months' notice, and it was a great 6 months, because no one could sack me in 6 months because I was already leaving and I had a much better job to go to because I was going to be employed by myself. I got a nice contract and enough money to actually give me some kind of financial security. And it was a very pleasant farewell, and they gave me a lovely statuette made of a kind of nice dull grey metal. Which I really treasure, and I mean, keep it by my bed because it saves having to switch the light on when I read. But enough of that. Back to Terry Pratchett, the writer, because there is going to be a point to all this. I finished Equal Rights, and then I wrote more. And possibly began a habit which has led to the fact that I'm now on blood pressure pills. I lived in dread of not having work in progress. And I developed the habit of starting a book on the same day as I'd finished the last one. There was one occasion where I had a schedule of 400 words a day. I would, if I could finish the book on 300 words, I wrote 100 words of the next book. Granddad died, shame. Go to the funeral, 400 words. Christmas time, nip out after dinner, 400 words. And I did that for years and years and years. Because if you have not got work in progress when you're a writer, you are in fact not a writer at all, you are a bum. And I thought that if I stopped writing, the magic would go away. And I was getting some successes. The books were selling very well. A book had got to number two in the bestseller lists. Sorcery got to number one in the bestseller lists and stayed in the top 10 for 3 months. And that started a trend which has continued to this day. I have lost count of how many books I've sold. I've heard 50 million. I really don't know. There are so many books and all the backlist is in print. America turned out to be a problem. Some of you may have been privy to me begging on my knees for a Hugo last night. For a wannabe stand-up comedian like me, you'll do anything for a laugh. Would I like a Hugo? Well, I actually know that for most of my writing career I've been ineligible because my publishing history in the US in the early days was marked by sliding publication dates, publishing out of sequence, publishing uncorrected, publishing with my name written wrong. There were so many things. Publishing and not telling anyone that you'd done it, which is a bit of a loser. That in fact, by about 1998, I was quite prepared to officially hand over the US publication rights to a UK publisher, because some of you people, in fact many of you people, I suspect, were part of the new Underground Railroad by which tens of thousands of British hardcovers were actually coming into the United States. My publishers at the time didn't seem to get their head around this, and you'd see one of my editors at a signing tour at a Worldcon where I signed UK hardcover after UK hardcover, and they didn't seem to think that this was wrong. My American agent said, no, wait a bit, I think things are going to change. And what happened was there was a big shake-up at HarperCollins, and at last I had a publisher who thought, this guy is selling gazillions but not here, let's do something about it. And I had an editor that really wanted to edit me, and I had a publicist that knew my name. But in 1996, I did a signing tour, which was miserable and horrible, and I spent all my time flying backwards from hub to hub and living on lard balls and salt licks, which is what you live on at airports. And it was a terrible tour, and I didn't want to do another one, so when they asked me to tour in the year 2000, I sent in a big list of demands, thinking, ha-ha, they're not going to fall for this, and they did. and the list of demands were things like, I'm not going to do any radio station called Good Morning City I've Never Been To Before and Will Be Leaving in 2 hours. I'm not going to take any flight that gets me into a hotel later than about 7 o'clock in the evening. Arriving at a hotel at 1 o'clock is not good. I think it was Rocky Frisco saved me in Madison, Wisconsin, because he had some cold pizza. That's life in the fast lane, folks. You got in at midnight, you get cold pizza. Did a tour in 2000. The smallest signing I did then was bigger than the biggest signing I'd done in 1996. Did a tour a couple of years ago, same size crowds, bit bigger maybe than an English tour. Suddenly, it seems I'm selling in the US. And who knows, with a bit of effort all round, within a few years, I might get up to where we could have been in about 1996. And yet I feel like a fraud. It's all been done in fun, folks. I had no big plan. I wrote the first few books for fun. I wrote the next books for fun. I did it because I really wanted to do it. I did it because I got something out of it. I was a fan, a real convention-going fan, for only maybe 3 years. Went to a couple of them in the early 60s, went to a Worldcon, got a job, started courting girls, and suddenly was whirled away into what may loosely be called real life. Although I have to say, when you work on a newspaper, life doesn't appear to be all that real. And in 1973, I was telling Pete Reston about this last night, there was a convention in my area. And I thought, I ought to go back. You know, it's been, 8 years since I last went to a con. And I walked in and there was no one I recognised. And I just couldn't kind of get a handle on it. And I sometimes wonder what would have happened if I had gone in and gone back into fandom right there and then. Mind you, I do recall that Salman Rushdie actually came second in a science fiction writing competition organised by Gollancz in the late 1970s. Just imagine if he had won. You know, Ayatollahs from Mars. He would have had none of that trouble over the satanic verses. He'd have been coming along, you know, to cons. He'd be standing here now. but the little turns and twists of history are there. Now, I've got bookmarks here to a file I cannot open. It doesn't actually... where do the ideas come from? I do not know. One of the things I did learn from my science fiction reading were that there were other things that you could read besides science fiction. And I developed a love of history, which school had singularly failed to inculcate into me. I'm now in correspondence with my old history master, and we get on very well. But they hadn't told me the things that were really interesting. That, you know, for a large part of the 19th century, you could actually get pubs to pay you to take urine away, and the tanners would actually pay you to have urine delivered to them. That's an interesting fact, and it's even more fun to know it when you're 14 years old. And I've done all... we've opened... I have to admit that I'm currently in a position of having more bookshelf space than I have books. However, this, of course, is not counting all those books in the attic, the books under the bed in the spare room, the books wrapped up in protective paper in the garage. I mean, they're the books that you kind of have. You know, they're like Stonehenge. No one's ever going to do anything with them now, but you obviously keep them. But you know, I actually have blank shelves. I've got at least 8 feet of blank shelves in my new library. I am sorry. But we went off to an antiquarian bookseller's the other week and I spent several hundred quid and now I've got, probably only about 4 foot of shelving now to fill. Because that is one of the nice things. I've made a lot of money out of the books, a considerable amount. But I am horizontally wealthy. I advise you all to consider horizontal wealth. If you're vertically wealthy, you think, I am rich, so I had better do what rich people do. What do rich people do? Well, first of all, they find out where the hell Gestad is, and then they go skiing there. They buy a yacht. They go to beaches a long way away. Well, first of all, never buy a yacht. Yachts are like tearing up 100-pound notes while standing under a cold shower. A nail, a perfectly ordinary nail, costs five times as much if it's a nautical nail. Though my PA is on at me to buy a light aircraft because he could fly it. But he was training to be a fighter pilot, so maybe I don't want this to happen. I bought what I wanted to buy. Big, big computers. Lots and lots of books. And these things aren't really all that expensive. Admittedly, the power dips when the computer goes on, but I can afford to pay that. We thought we were posh because we had a house with a library. Now we have a house with about three libraries. Of course, not counting the books in the attic, the books in the garage, and the books under the bed. And these are all, in there are books relict of, I don't know, time when I was 13. And I read absolutely everything I could get my hands on, and found interesting things everywhere. Let me tell you, for example, the story of Tarlatane, uncovered in newspaper accounts in the mid-1850s. Tarlatane was a kind of false silk made in, I think, Lower Saxony. A mineral was ground up and mixed with paste and rubbed into a cloth and polished in such a way that you got something that looked a bit like silk. And it was a lovely, brilliant green, and this young lady attended a ball for troops going to the Crimea in London one sultry summer's night. And she had a dress made of tarlatane and shoes made of tarlatane and a parasol of tarlatane and a bag made of tarlatane. And she danced the night away in this closed, rather humid ballroom. And little flecks of green spiraled off her dress as she whirled and danced from partner to partner. And then she went home, and she felt a bit ill. And then she felt very ill. And after 2 days of horrible torment, she died. How do you make tarlatane? You make it out of arsenic. And this is terrible, and it is tragic. But for an author, you look up, and you see the glow, the whirling dancer, the beautiful girl, the deadly green glitter in the air. That is so cool! And in fact, no one else apart from her died, although a number of people were quite seriously ill. But you say, okay, there is going to be a book where this turns up. I was reading an old book on alchemy, and it talked about an alchemist in Austria, who got can't remember which king it was, to pardon him. He was brought before the king on charges of falsely claiming to be able to make gold. He could see the king was unwell, recognised the symptoms of arsenical poisoning, and made a bargain that if he could cure the king, the emperor, sorry, of Austria, he would be allowed to go free. He tested everything. He tested bread, he tested meat, he tested the water. The emperor got worse and worse. Then he got hold of one of the candles and weighed it, went down to the market and bought another candle of the same size and weighed that, and found that one candle was a pound heavier than the other, because the wick was almost solid arsenic. Lovely stuff, arsenic. And every night when the candles were lit, the emperor was slowly poisoned, and that became part of the plot of Feet of Clay. Where do you get your ideas from? You steal them. And I wish I could tell you how many other incidences there are. In The Wee Free Men, the village has a tradition of burying a shepherd with a piece of wool on his shroud so that the recording angel will excuse him from all those times he failed to attend church. because he was a shepherd, and a good shepherd should know that the sheep come first. I didn't make that up. They used to do that in a village 2 miles from where I live. And what I particularly liked about it, it was a loyalist arrangement. Americans, I think, sometimes get puzzled in Ireland. People who call themselves loyalists may be taking up arms against the crown. But a loyalist arrangement is a little more complex. It doesn't mean we will be loyal to you whatever. It means we will be loyal to you if you are loyal to us. If you act like a king should act, you can be our king. And it seemed to me that these humble the humble people of the village, putting their little piece of wool on the shroud, were saying, if you are the God we think you are, you will understand. And if you're not the God we think you are, to hell with you. And that's where so much of this world has come from. So much that I could no longer come up with specific incidences. I read and read and read throughout my teens. I was a child born just before the TV generation, so it never caught on. I haunted all the bookshops. I read every book I could find. I picked up stuff that I don't know where I learned it. I just thought it kind of drifted down out of the atmosphere. The first book I ever bought for myself was Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable. There are some milestones in my career, and one that I'm possibly most proud of is that I was asked to write an introduction for the millennium edition of Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable. I've got just about all possible editions of it. A great, great help to a fantasy writer when I needed to find out exactly how you built a clock of flowers that could tell you what time of day it was, I turned first the Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable, and there it was. So that's where I get my ideas from. I look them up in books. How do you write the stories? You make them up as you go along. This is a terrible thing to have to tell people, but I've spoken to other authors, and when there is no one else nearby, that's what we agree that we do. Currently, I'm writing the next adult Discworld book. What I have is a title. I have a children's book. Somewhere in this story, there is a children's book. And the children's book is called Where's My Cow? And Commander Vimes is reading to young Sam Vimes, who's just over a year old. And young Sam Vimes must be read to at 6 o'clock every night, no matter what the commander of police is doing, no matter how serious the political murder he's investigating, he will go home to read to his little boy out of Where's My Cow? Where's My Cow has a very small vocabulary. It has been chewed all around the edges. And the question is, that's not my cow. That's not my cow. That's a sheep. A sheep goes baa. And you turn the page. That's not my cow. That is a hippopotamus. A hippopotamus goes grunt. And Vimes reads this every night and thinks, this kid lives in a city. A big, big city. The only sound that animals make in the city is sizzle. And he looks around, and the nursery's got sheep on the wallpaper, and bunny rabbits, and foxes, and giraffes with waistcoats. He says, why? Why? And he thinks, what would the urban children's storybook be like? You know, with all the seamstresses and the beggars and things like that. What kind of noise does the beggars make? For some money, I won't follow you home. I know that in this book, which is barely under construction, there's going to be a moment where Vimes is reading through it for the umpteenth time, and this book is soggy. I mean, his son goes to sleep chewing this rag book, and he's going to look at it, and he's at the back of his mind is this terribly complex crime, and he's going to say,
"That's not my cow," and rush off after putting his son to bed, of course, because family duty comes first, and it's going to help him solve the crime. I don't even know what the crime is yet. I spoke to Neil about this the other day, and it's exactly the same thing. You have this little oasis of exactly the right piece of plot, and you know it's going to work, and you have no idea what the connective tissue is. The book's called Thud because it's based on a game called Thud, which is actually available in the UK, and it's a game between trolls and dwarves, and specifically designed to be played by trolls and dwarves. Maybe that's why we're not selling many to humans. But also, in a kind of nod towards Dashiell Hammett, it's a good way of starting a murder mystery. Thud! That's the sound he made when he hit the ground. Unfortunately for me, at the same time as this, I am also writing the next book in the Tiffany and the Wee Free Men series. Writing two books at the same time, while it's incredibly bad for your health, and I'm on 6 pills a day already, which has given me the water retaining capabilities of a drain pipe. Writing two books at the same time is actually quite good because you can take a rest from writing one to write the other. Now you know how I got where I am today. And again, I'm writing scenes which are really good, and I don't know where they're going to fit in the book, but it's like what I call the valley filled with clouds. You're at the edge of the valley, and there's a church steeple, and there's a tree, and there's a rocky outcrop, but the rest of it is mist. But you know that because they exist, there must be ways of getting from one to the other that you cannot see. And so you start the journey. And when I write, I write a draft entirely for myself just to find out what the book is going to be all about. I'm sure true writers do not work like this. I know for a fact that Larry Niven uses lots of little postcards and writes the outline of each scene on one. I know this because once upon a time we discussed doing a beanstalk story together, and both of us wanted to do it. And after some discussion, we agreed two things: that any of the ideas we'd come up with in that discussion, either of us could use, because what were ideas after all? And the other was that there was no way on God's good earth that two of us could ever collaborate at anything, because the style simply would not, well, not the styles, the style of working simply would not interlock. And it's got, and I think I've suffered the whole time by thinking, no one ever taught me to write. No one ever told me what I was doing wrong. They just published the books. And so I've been learning as I go, and I find it rather embarrassing now that people beginning the Discworld series start with The Colour of Magic and The Light Fantastic, which I don't think are some of the best books to start with. This is the author saying this, folks. Do not start at the beginning with Discworld. The books I'm really proudest of having written are the children's books, and it was actually brought home to me today when I was talking to the kids why this is. They started asking about the turtles. Then they continued asking about the turtle. And I said, OK, no turtle questions. OK, well, about the elephants then. And the thing is that when you write for kids, you have to be more precise. You have to answer the questions. You can't leave people hanging around. You can't rely on them filling in too many gaps for themselves. But also, kids are remarkably astute. They've got plot savvy. I suppose I can say this. I remember my daughter watching a movie many years ago. She was about 8 or 9, perhaps. And it was an action adventure. And she said, "That black guy is going to survive." And this was about a third of the way through. And we knew it's that kind of movie, that lots and lots of people are going to get killed. I said, "How do you know?" I said, "How do you know?" "Well, that guy's going to survive, and that woman's going to survive, and the black guy's going to survive, because that's how many people of the right sort survive in this kind of movie." actually, she was actually wrong. The black guy got it very nearly close to the end, but he survived for quite a long time. But the woman and the man escaped. But already she'd been working out how plots work, and kids are doing that. So it really stretches me to write the children's books. I think I've probably done great harm to the world of fantasy. Fortuitously, although I'm not very cerebral about what I write, I have to wind up. I've got an hour, have I not?
Keep going.
Oh, I'm going to keep going. Right. They can always phone me up. Right. Lots and lots of people are doing theses and doctorates on me. And so apparently I'm a postmodern fantasy writer. I think that means that means that I've got a condom factory in Ankh-Morpork. And the nice thing is that Ankh-Morpork can survive this. Admittedly, the troll that does all the packing wonders what the women are laughing about when he's packing the big boys. But you cannot imagine a condom machine in Middle Earth. Well, actually, I can. But you certainly can't imagine one in Narnia, and nor should you. But the curious thing is, Ankh-Morpork can survive this. That's why I'm so pleased at the way things have caught on. Ankh-Morpork does survive. I have two fans in the Royal College of Heralds, or the Royal College of Arms, and said, you know, you could have a coat of arms. And I said, could it have hippos on either side of it, like the Ankh-Morpork one? No, you can't do that. You have to be either the queen or a city. I said, well, yeah. But I personally am not a city, so I can't have... So I said, well, I could do it anyway, couldn't I? I mean, what happens if I do it? Well, we won't like it. So I thought, this is 2004, I could live with that. But they really were impressed with the city motto of Ankh-Morpork, Quanti canicula illa in fenestra, which does translate very nicely as, how much is that doggy in the window? Once the shuttle is flying again, there are secret plans afoot to get the mission patch from the last hero on board in some way. I suspect that the Latin motto for it, when translated, will have specific meaning, since it reads, "We who are about to die don't want to." It has been tremendous fun. It's made me a lot of money. I wish I was a real author. I truly do. I haven't thought a great deal about what I've done. I've gone ahead and done it. It comes as a huge shock to read these theses that sleet in about the rate of one every month or two, and find out about my wonderful use of language and the cleverness which I do these things. And I think, nah. You just do it because that's what it's like. That thing goes there because it's impossible to imagine it going in any other place. And then they go and make me a guest of honour. There are far, far better authors out there, folks. But I thank you very much for reading this one. It has been tremendous fun. Discworld is 21 years old next month, which kind of means something in England even now. Once upon a time, it was when you were allowed to drink, but now you're officially allowed to drink at the age of about 8 years old. But somehow it means that it's come of age. I'm pleased to tell you that my heart is holding out very well. And although I now intend to write only one book a year, the trouble is that will give me spare time. And my wife pointed out recently that the last time we went on holiday, I wrote a quarter of a book in 2 weeks. Well, it was in Australia. It was great. You could get up early. The birds were singing. There was a fridge full of cold beer. It was 6 a.m. The sun was out. And so I sat and wrote, and it was great fun. And then the place we go to in Australia, where do I get my ideas from? The place we go to Australia, it's a little lodge up in the rainforest, but close to the sea. There's no kids and no dogs. Why not? Because the sharks eat them. Truly. And if the sharks don't get you, the saltwater crocodiles will. And if the saltwater crocodiles don't get you, the box jellyfish will. We like that place. What we particularly like about it is the tennis court and golf course, because it doesn't have them. And I remember our first walk in the rainforest there, and you go around the corner, and there is a spider the size of the palm of your hand in its web going... And what you do, well, you creep round, a long way round, like half a mile round, if necessary. And we were climbing up this cliff, holding onto a rope, and a honeymoon couple had climbed up before me, and I was climbing up, and it was starting to rain, and I was looking where I put my feet, and I was looking down, and there was this big snake strangling a goanna. So I called down to the guide and said, "There's a snake!" And he said, "What sort?" And I cried out, I'm halfway up a cliff, it's raining hard, I'm holding onto a rope, I'm beginning to slip, and I'm not going to play What's My Snake. But, I think it's a kind of python. Why do you think it's a kind of python? Because the goanna's eyes are going out like this. And so he came up and said, "Oh, that's all right, yeah, no worries, kick it into the bushes." So we prodded it gently into the bushes. And that was my first walk in the Australian rainforest. And from that, the last continent came. My suspicion is that I'm here for an hour, but no one is actually turning us out yet. And the putative speech, which is in this machine, which is going to get a thorough good kicking in a minute, is effectively over. But I'll has anyone got a question? I feel kind of hyper and I haven't finished my gin. Ma'am.
I wanted to ask you if you have any intention or plan or think you'll ever write what happened to young Sam Vine
at Night Watch? Yeah. In other words, will I write a fill-in novel between Night Watch and the modern day? I don't know. I don't know what I'll do. There is a light science fiction novel that I'm planning to write. I've been planning to write it for years and years and years. There are lots of other books that I want to write. As they say, so many books, so little time. Someone else? Ma'am. Are there going to be any more books for children that aren't the Bromeliad, that aren't Discworld? There might be. I mean, again, you're falling into the error of thinking that my life is under any kind of control. Sir. Sorry, who? I'm taking a great deal of interest in death right now. I'm reading Death's Acre, which is heaps of fun, and taking a lot of interest in forensic stuff, because disintegrating bodies is quite an interesting subject. I don't know. That would be between her and death. But I think death is mostly there to reassure you that although you are dead, there is a you to know that you are dead. And I think many of us would take some comfort from that. Sir, Sorry, it may be Madam. All I can see here is an outline. I was an idiot when I was 10. But it was when I was 10 that I started to read. When I was 5, I couldn't read. I didn't start reading till I was 7 or 8. My mother bribed me to read. I think I got like a shilling for reading a page all the way through. You could see I was a kind of author even then, you know. But I didn't start reading for pleasure until I was about 9 or 10 because there were books in the house, and my parents thought that reading was a good idea because reading got you a job where you didn't have to work with your hands. But school had never actually explained that reading was fun. Is there another event in here? No, obviously not. Okay, I'll go. Someone phone me out. Hand up over there. Right. How come I like strong, capable women? I'm sure I've told some of you this already. I am an honorary brownie. They're like the small Girl Scouts. I was made one as a result of writing The Wee Free Men, and they thought I could really write 9-year-old girls very well. There's not many 56-year-old men who are brownies and have got a brownie scarf, and even fewer who would admit it if they were. But I am rather pleased about that. It was partly watching my own daughter grow up, and I watch people all the time, and it's all people watching, and recollections of when I was a kid, and the girls always seemed more composed somehow than the boys. I mean, around about 14, or 13 or 14, the girls have got it all worked out, and the boys are going around going, boo. And that's kind of an interesting age. It worried my daughter when I was writing some of that stuff, because she said, how do you know this? How do you know what it's like at children's parties? And I said, because I've waited for you, you know, your friend's children. I know what it's like, and I went to children's parties when I was a kid, and there's always some idiot that pours alcohol in the punch and that sort of thing. It's always been the same ever since, you know, creation. And I just use my imagination. I find it very, very hard to write weak women characters. Scratch a Pratchett heroine and you'll get scratched back. The quote, I think, that sums it up was from... it is in one of the Johnny Maxwell books where... Kirsty, the heroine, says, just my luck to be having an adventure with 4 token boys. You had a question, sir. I think because of the line of sight, we probably have at least 3 people answering that question. The lady standing up with the... Yeah, that's you that's just looking round with the curly hair. I'll take your question. Ho ho, the Good Omens question. Neil is here. We could do such a great gig together. We the point is, we've agreed on all the lies. No, I mean, this would have been the real cool moment for him to step through the doors. Okay, the official lies about Good Omens. Put the hands down a minute because it'll take it just a moment. You've got to remember that in those days, he wasn't Neil Gaiman and I wasn't Terry Pratchett. So people say, what was it like to work with Neil Gaiman? whereas the normal response to the name of either of us, unless you were really into the genre back in the late 80s was who? And so we had freedom, absolute freedom. We had freedom to mess up. It's now been written down so often that it must be true. Neil wrote half a short story that was the core of Good Omens, asked me to have a look at it and tell him how it ended, and I said I didn't know how it ended, but I knew how it continued. And in fact, by the time I said it, I then rewrote the story from the beginning because Neil didn't have any other copy of it, and there was no real, there wasn't internet, or that certainly that we had access to. We put discs in the post to each other every day. We did actually try direct modem-to-modem communication on 1275 baud modems. Ask your grandparents, kids. And that didn't work because we had only one phone line each, because in the UK that's how things were. But nevertheless, it got done, and lots of it, and most of it's by me, and most of it's by him. And there are some bits that we are allowed to say are entirely our own. I did most of the kids, which I think is probably fairly easily recognisable, and I certainly did all of Agnes Nutter. Everything else, Neil did. Well, he numbered the pages. No. At this point, there's a genuine thing. When we were going through the proofs, we went up to Gollancz to go through the proofs together with our editor down in some cellar, and I don't know, can't remember now who started this, but one of us burst out laughing and said, "That was a good bit you did," and the other one said, "I didn't write that bit, you did. I don't remember writing that." And it was full of, and the thing is full of these bits that one or other of us probably wrote and the other one rewrote or pointed up or sharpened or repositioned. Neil's wife tried to identify the bits that were definitely by him and got them wrong. And we had a tremendous amount of fun. It mostly consisted of a lengthy telephone call every day with us shouting at one another, "Sir, I have your face imprinted. I will take your question next." Absolutely you, sir. Yeah, but no, sit down a moment. I'll finish this one, but I felt for your hand. Who knows who wrote what? The whole thing now is just... It was stirred up and mixed around. I had, shall we say, more editorial control, and I was the keeper of the master copy, and that was how it should be if we were doing a graphic novel. Neil would have had the equivalent thing. And everyone wanted us to write a sequel, and we kind of pretended to the other guy that we wanted to write a sequel, and it was a wonderful day when we confessed to the other to each other, "Actually, we don't want to want a, you know, a sequel wouldn't be as good, would it? No. I want to do other stuff. What about you?" "Yeah, I want to do other stuff." "Good, let's shake hands on it. We're not going to write a sequel." What a relief! Because we definitely think that the sequel that we haven't written is probably better than any sequel that we could write. And imagine, how would we do it now? Think of the fuss. You know, his people have got to talk to my people, and my people have got to find me, and it... And just lining up the schedules would be so hard. And I mean, how? Where would we put all the money? I mean, for both of us, Good Omens, we've got a real soft spot for Good Omens, especially the ones that have been dropped in parsnip soup, are all fluffy and twice the thickness that they should be, are held together with brown sticky tape, and fall apart as you touch them. I've tried all kinds of tricks to get a laugh on a signing tour, and I used to carry surgical gloves to handle those copies of Good Omens. And this, it's been still around. It's still buoyantly in print. It signally failed to win any major awards. And it just sells and it sells. And we always say, if you're on a signing tour, the first book you're going to be asked to sign is the latest hardback. The second book is the latest paperback. The third book is the manky copy of Good Omens. It was great, and everyone ought to do it once.